seems to be working. Okay, so the subject of this talk is the nature of singularities in general relativity, which is an old subject that's been around for a long time, and I'd like to just start with a reminder of some historical things which happened a long time ago. So the first thing is, of course, that we know certain explicit solutions with singularities which have been around for a long time, notably the Schwarzschild solution and the Friedmann solution. These are then prototypes for black hole singularities in the case of Schwarzschild and cosmological singularities in the case of Friedmann. These solutions, of course, like most exact solutions, have very high symmetry, and the obvious question you can ask is, are the singularities in these models just an artifact of symmetry? Now, in the early 1960s, Kolatnikov and Lifshitz did a calculation from which they concluded that this was, in fact, the case, that the singularities which are found in these spacetimes are, in fact, only artifacts of the symmetry, and if you perturb these in a generic way, then the singularities will go away. So what they did was a formal calculation. They worked in Gauss coordinates, and they made a certain ansatz for the metric involving the full number of free functions, and then they discovered no contradiction, so the ansatz seemed to be consistent. And within that ansatz, they found that the singularities there were not physical singularities. For instance, there was no blow-up of curvature. And this had a lot to do with the use of Gaussian coordinates. Then, in the mid-60s, there came, of course, the singularity theorems of Penrose and Hawking. And so they were able to prove mathematically that under very general circumstances, there are singularities in solutions of the Einstein equations, and therefore their result, which was a mathematically rigorous result, contradicted the formal calculations of Kolatnikov and Lifshitz. Now, with hindsight, you can ask, what did Kolatnikov and Lifshitz do wrong? What was the point? And basically, the point was that what they were finding, they found very general singularities of a certain type, but those singularities were, in fact, just the singularities of Gauss coordinates. So it's well known that if you start with Gauss coordinates in a perfectly regular space-time, then usually they break down after a finite time. And if you've written your solution in Gauss coordinates, then that looks like a singularity. So that's a kind of mistake which probably or hopefully people wouldn't make today, because if you find some statement like this, you would always want to know, does it have a coordinate invariant meaning or doesn't it? And if you looked at that question, you'd be likely to realize that the problem was just with Gaussian coordinates.
But I thought you said their conclusion was that the singularities are not generic.
That's correct, that physical singularities are not generic. So they were saying, take generic initial data and look what happens, and you find a singularity, and that singularity is not a curvature singularity or anything. It's just a coordinate singularity.
Does that mean if the coordinate, if you use Gaussian coordinates, you always get a coordinate singularity before you get a regular, a real singularity?
At least in generic situations.
Right, in generic situations.
Yeah. So if they use something else and evolve farther somehow, they would have seen a real physical singularity in most of those cases.
That's right. So they had found one consistent asymptotics, but it wasn't, in fact, the interesting consistent asymptotics.
So the epitaph on too soon would be stop too soon.
Yeah, you could say that. But, well, they didn't stop too soon because they tried again, and they'll be coming to that. So that's the point I've come to now, which is the work of Bilinski, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz, who I will always abbreviate by BKL, and this was work which was started in the early 70s and carried on until about the early 80s. And so what they did was, again, they did a formal expansion. Again, they used Gaussian coordinates, but now they took into account what had been learned from the singularity theorems, and they came up with a much more complicated picture of what the generic singularity should be like. So this is what I'll call the BKL picture, and I want to mention some of the features of this BKL picture. Okay, so one important feature of the BKL picture is that you get decoupling of the equations at different spatial points. Now, of course, you can ask, what do we mean by different spatial points? Invariantly, I will pass over that question, and hopefully you'll see later on what it could mean. So I won't worry about that problem at the moment. The second point is the unimportance of matter near the singularity. Here, unimportance must be understood in the right sense. In fact, the density is going to infinity, so in that sense, the matter is important. Nevertheless, the idea is that the matter has a negligible effect on the essential aspects of the dynamics. So, in other words, something else is going even faster to infinity, therefore the influence of the curvature is negligible.
It's true no matter what the density is.
This is not completely general. In fact, later on I'll be talking about a case where this is not the case, but this would be, for instance, if you took, and this is what they did at that time, if you take a radiation fluid, so a perfect fluid with equation of state p equals a third rho, then this statement is supposed to hold. And then the third point which belongs to that picture is again the Gauss coordinates. So there are Gauss coordinates such that the singularity is t equals zero. So the singularity is simultaneous. Now there are some hopefully not. Otherwise it wouldn't work. No, of course you've got a big choice of Gauss coordinates. And now, I mean, here, this is something which was a big point of criticism of the BKL scenario. How could you hope to have Gauss coordinates which really fit to the singularity that well? And that's, on the one hand it's a reasonable criticism, but on the other hand it's not an absolute criticism, because to start with, you don't know that there might not be one very nice Gauss coordinate system which does the job. And in fact, in the examples I'll discuss later, we will see that that's the case. There really is a Gauss coordinate system which, and the Gaussian time coordinate will be unique, which fits the singularity perfectly. So there are some problematic things about this BKL picture which might make people skeptical and have made people skeptical about it. The one is this idea that you could take a complicated system of partial differential equations like the Einstein equation, and everything would basically just reduce to ordinary differential equations, which is what this decoupling means, is, I mean, it's a pretty dramatic phenomenon. So if you're saying something like that happens, you better have good arguments to show that that is, in fact, what does happen. The thing about the Gauss coordinates I already mentioned. Now, if you take all these points together, then you very soon... Oh, I should say something else. I've been saying something about the problematic aspects of this BKL picture, but I should also say what's positive about it compared to the singularity theorems, because the singularity theorems tell you there is a singularity, but they say nothing about what it's like. They give you absolutely no information other than there is an incomplete causal geodesic. And this picture, if it were right, would tell you much, much more about the structure of the singularity, and that's why it's so interesting to find out if there's something in this picture.
So one to review are their assumptions?
No, these are their conclusions that they're claiming. I mean, in a way, they're in a way assumptions as well, because what they're doing is they're saying, let's make an ansatz, yeah, and then it turns out to be consistent. That's the kind of logic of the argument. Okay, so if these three things really hold, then you very quickly end up with the so-called Mixmaster solution, so this is a spatially homogeneous space-time, which is Bianchi type 9 and vacuum. So why is Mixmaster important? Well, point one tells us we're going to get down to ODEs, which basically means we get down to the spatially homogeneous Einstein equations. Point two tells us we can really restrict to vacuum, therefore we get vacuum spatially homogeneous, and Bianchi 9 is in some sense the most general vacuum spatially homogeneous solution. Therefore you sort of automatically come to Mixmaster. Now, something that's problematic about this is that from a mathematical or rigorous point of view, we don't really understand Mixmaster very well. So you're saying basically you have a complicated problem and you try to model it on something else, but you don't understand the model. So that's problematic. And I should say that up until very recently, there had been no confirmation of this picture, either by rigorous mathematical arguments or by, let's say, trustworthy numerical calculations. So things were really wide open, I would say. Fortunately, this has changed somewhat recently. So I'll mention one or two things which have happened which are not directly relevant to what I'm going to say now, but just as part of the background. So if you count the degrees of freedom which are there, then the most general types are type 9 and type 8, and they're supposed to do roughly the same thing. There's also this funny thing about this so-called type 6 minus the 9th, which is equally general, but this is something which is they never mentioned and which has been kind of neglected, so this is a big question mark. This is also supposed to be to show some similar behavior to Mixmaster. But
do we restrict ourselves to type A from the beginning, or type A, class A from the beginning?
No. So this is class B. Yeah.
What's so mathematically hard about Mixmaster? Isn't it just a bunch of ordinary differential equations?
Yeah, ordinary differential equations can be very hard. Yeah, I mean it's a system of ordinary differential equations. So I mean, if you try and analyze this, what do? You can sort of write it as a dynamical system and think you've got some stationary points and look at linearize about the stationary points and so on and try and build up the picture. However, what it turns out is there are continua of stationary points, and these stationary points are also in other ways degenerate. And the whole thing is defined on a non-compact phase space, so things can escape to infinity, and there's lots of different ends where it's difficult to control things.
It's most general in the sense of number of variables, but another hand, it's not that dynamics you get here. The dynamics I'll get in here at the end tomorrow is a subcase of the dynamics I get here. That's a different situation.
No, the idea is that the amount of initial data you have for the other Bianchi types is less than the amount you have for Bianchi 9.
But the dynamics is different.
It's different, yeah.
Well, particularly when there's a big crunch around.
So, why do you think the system is not especially because A, B, 1, 2, 3 may all hold, but your real dynamics may go model by some other model or something else. They have less number of variables, but on the other hand, two dynamics.
Yes, but basically the other cases are all kind of simpler than Mixmaster. So their general picture contains all the possibilities, basically, if you ignore this thing here. And Mixmaster is just the most complicated one, and the one which is believed to be the generic one.
It's not that that's obvious. You have to look at the ODEs. I mean, you write the ODEs and they look different in each one of the classes, but then you see that the... by looking carefully at them, that the behavior of the others seems to be a subclass of the mix of the type 9 kind of behavior. In a face portrait kind of way.
But do they really say that each spatial point follows a particular solution of mixed master? I sort of thought it was maybe more general than that, but it's sort of like mixed master, but the coefficients of the bouncing terms can change.
At the moment, I'm not making any very specific statements. I'm just saying that Mixmaster is the kind of model here for a general space-time. And in what exact sense that is, I don't want to say at the moment.
I'm confused when you... because what you said sounds very different than what Vince said, which is what I thought I understood. I mean, the assumption is that every point is a different Mixmaster with practically independent degrees of freedom.
Yeah, in some sense, and the question is in what sense exactly?
Right, so at worst you have something which is really somehow distributional and, not differentiable altogether. Is that within the realm of practice? That is, somehow, as you go to these singularities and the different points become decoupled, it somehow it more and more looks as if you just have, an infinite product of systems which is non-differentiable.
No, the parameters are varying smoothly, at least at most points. So there are exceptional points where you expect some discontinuities. The picture is, here is the initial singularity, and now you evolve backwards, and the typical kind of picture you expect that there will be times when there are sort of bifurcations, and there are discontinuities which become more and more densely distributed, but most of the stuff is actually like a solution of Mixmaster depending on parameters and depending smoothly on parameters, in fact.
Are the discontinuities related to when the Mixmaster solution closed down from the wall?
Yes, they are. So what happens is if a new discontinuity comes up, it means that the stuff over here is bounced and the stuff over here hasn't. And that creates the bit more discontinuous. Anyway, I don't want to get too much into the Mixmaster stuff because that's sort of taking me off in the wrong direction. But I'm happy to discuss these things later on. So let me just say what has happened recently, which I think contributes to the understanding of Mixmaster before I sort of avoid Mixmaster, which will be the main direction of this talk. Namely, there has been some work by Hans Ringström, which seems to give a hope for understanding Mixmaster itself, and I believe he's going to be coming here later in this program, so maybe you'll hear more about that. Then there's numerical work due to Berger, Garfinkel, Eisenberg, Moncrief, and Weaver, I hope I haven't forgotten anybody, where they have been able to numerically show that Mixmaster behavior point-wise really does come up in spatially inhomogeneous spacetimes, and that's the first time that's ever been done. So that's all very encouraging. I mean, in a way, for a few years, I would quite like to find some way of proving this wrong, but as time has gone by, more and more evidence seems to have been accumulating that there is an awful lot in this picture, which is right. Okay, so now I come to what I briefly said already, namely, the policy will be in this talk to avoid Mixmaster. So find a situation where the complexities of Mixmaster are avoided, but where some of these elements here still persist, and try and show that rigorously that they really are there. And the elements which will persist will be this decoupling of the equations, which I said was one of the most surprising things, that you can approximate a solution of a PDE by a solution of ODEs, and the fact that you have global Gauss coordinates near the singularity will persist. What will be different is this question of the unimportance of matter, because here I will be specifically considering something where matter is important all the way to the singularity, and that this can happen is not a new thing. This was realized a long time ago by Belinsky and Kolatnikov again. And the situation in which this happens is if you couple the Einstein equations to a scalar field. And the scalar field now means massless, minimally coupled, real scalar field. So what they noticed was that if you have a scalar field, then instead of the complicated oscillatory behavior which is characteristic of Mixmaster, you get a much more uniform behavior. And that's something which is somehow easier to describe and easier to prove something about. A generalization of this, in a sense, is if you take a stiff fluid, that is to say a fluid with equation of state P equals rho, in the situations that you're interested in here, near the singularity, the gradient of the scalar field is always time-like, and under those circumstances, the scalar field is equivalent to the irrotational special case of the stiff fluid. So these are sort of very similar things. I'll be concentrating here on the scalar field, but I hope later to be able to do similar things for the stiff fluid. There was another discovery, I think, independent of the same phenomenon, which was due to John Barrow. And this, among other things, gave me the title for my talk, because he introduced what he called quiescent cosmology. So that was back in the old pre-inflation days. And questions that people were asking at that time were, why does the universe look so small, so smooth, and what should the equation of state be at high densities? And there were various suggestions for that. And what Barrow noticed was that if you take a stiff fluid, then that gives you a possibility for producing very smooth universes from a very wide range of initial data, in fact from essentially very general initial data. And you don't have this, so this was again within the framework of BKL, that if you do that kind of analysis, you see that the scalar field essentially kills the oscillations and you get a much simpler picture. So this is, quiescent cosmology has been forgotten for a long time, however it's had a kind of resurrection by the back door, and there are people who now do what they call string cosmology. And so what is this? So there is something called string cosmology. I don't say that it's what everybody calls that, but what some people call it, which is just equivalent, the equations are just the Einstein equations coupled to a massless scalar field. And where that comes from is, I think you've all heard this kind of statement that there's a low energy limit of string theory which produces Einstein's theory. Now, actually, what it produces is not exactly Einstein's theory, but Einstein's theory plus a whole bunch of other matter fields. And now, if you're very radical, you just set all the matter fields to zero, then you get Einstein's theory. If you're slightly less radical, you set all the matter fields except one to zero. And that's the dilaton. And if you just keep the dilaton, then that will be the scalar field, and then the field equations are equivalent to the Einstein scalar field system, whereby it's necessary to pay attention to the fact that the metric there is not the physical metric. So if you, it's like Gram-Zdicky theory, if you formulate the theory as Einstein scalar field, then the true physical metric, which is seen by the strings, is that metric you're working with times some function of the dilaton as a conformal factor. Okay, so that's the fairly long introduction. And now I want to come to the more specific topic of this talk, which is work I've been doing with Lars Andersen recently on trying to give a rigorous treatment of this BKL picture for the case of the Einstein scalar field equations. And of course, the reason, as I've already said, for choosing the Einstein scalar field equations is that it allows us to avoid some of the worst difficulties with mixed master, or with oscillatory singularities, let me say, to be not too specific. Okay, so so now I have to go into the BKL picture in a bit more detail. So if I'm in Gauss coordinates, then I can write the metric as minus dt squared plus some spatial piece, and the sigma i's here are just some spatial frame, and this at the moment says nothing, it's just a general metric. And something which comes up over and over again is that life would be much easier if this metric were diagonal. And originally BKL took it to be diagonal, and if you don't take it to be diagonal, you have a lot of headaches, as we've been seeing in the past couple of weeks, trying to do calculations of these things. So just to start with, in order to see roughly what's going on, let's consider the diagonal case. So we just have minus dt squared plus, and now let me write out sum explicitly, sum over I, gii of t and x. And then there are these frames, which are, they're not time dependent. Sorry, the sigma I. So this would be the form of the metric. And now the ansatz is something which says something about these coefficients gii, namely that they are of the form gii of t and x is equal to a leading term, which is a g naught ii only depending on x, times the power of t, where the exponent also depends on x, plus lower order terms.
Lower order in t?
In t.
What is topology, did he
say? There's no topological assumption here. This is all basically local in space.
So it could be in particular non-compact.
Yeah, so the only place where the spatial topology will play a role in what I will say is when it comes to solving the constraints. But all the rest is purely local. And the reason you can do it purely locally has to do with the fact that you have, well, basically all around particle horizons, you have a finite domain of dependence near a singularity of this type, so you can, if you have a singularity like that, you can always localize in space.
You're assuming that if it takes this form near t equals 0?
Yeah, so this is, let's say, the aim is, in the end, to prove that there are a lot of metrics which have this form and to parameterize them by suitable data. Roughly speaking, data on the singularity.
Do the p's satisfy the Kasner
conditions? The p's here satisfy one of the Kasner conditions. Their sum is 1. So these are, I'll call these Kasner exponents, in fact. So the sum of the PIs is equal to 1. If we were doing the case without a scalar field, we would also have sum of the PI squared is equal to 1. But here, sum of the PI squared is equal to 1 minus something which comes from the scalar field. And that's, in fact, so maybe this is worth to say explicitly. So this is 1 minus something, let me just put in angle brackets, something that comes from the scalar field. And this is extremely important because the favorable case is if all the PI are positive. And now if you have the Kasner relations with this, then it cannot be the case that all the PI are positive. However, if you have this extra freedom, you can make all the PI positive. And that's, in a way, what the scalar field does for you.
You're not assuming any symmetry?
No. No symmetry. Assumed.
Sorry,
I had a
question. So, I mean, the question which I guess has come up before is, I mean, if you have a generic singularity, you have to wonder what would happen when the scalar field would collapse or what folds. Not chopped up. Various behavior. But you're ruling that out somehow by
making the bottom. That is ruled out, but the sort of more general logic is what we're looking for is we can't really say a generic solution. It's rather we're looking for a kind of singularity which is to be found for a whole non-empty open set of initial data. So it's something like a stability statement rather than a genericity statement. So in other words, the basic kind of thing will be to say, if you take a Friedman model, and if you take the data from that, and now if you perturb that not too much, which is not an arbitrarily small epsilon, as we'll see, but we can really give a number, then the nature of the singularity persists and still has this form. But of course, if you went arbitrarily far away, you could worry that more complicated things would happen, and presumably they would. So I will be able to say things about the scalar field, but at the moment I'm just trying to give you a general idea of what is the structure of this singularity. But in fact, I mean, later on I'll write down exactly how the scalar field behaves. Okay, so one important point here is this point of diagonalization, which I already mentioned. So it's really, what is the real problem here? The problem is, imagine you have these metric coefficients which have a certain leading behavior, and you also have the time derivatives which have a certain leading behavior. It would make life very easy if you could simultaneously diagonalize these two things. Now, you might say, well, what's the problem? We have two symmetric matrices, and one of them is positive definite, so we can always simultaneously diagonalize them. But the problem is that they depend on x, so that they're parameter-dependent matrices. And then you can diagonalize them simultaneously at each point, but you can't do it smoothly in x, in general. Whenever the multiplicity of the eigenvalues changes, you can't smoothly diagonalize. And now, it just unfortunately happens to be the case that what we're most interested in is somewhere near Friedman, and Friedman has an eigenvalue of multiplicity 3, so wherever you go the multiplicity changes. So it's a particularly unfortunate case, if you like. I mean, I don't want to go too much into that point, but it really is, maybe it's just a technical difficulty, but it causes an awful lot of problems. Okay, so now the general kind of existence statement we would like to have, and I think I've more or less said this already, is we would like to be able to give something which we could call data at the singularity, and say, given data at the singularity, there exists a unique solution of the Einstein equations whose asymptotic behavior corresponds to that data. That's the kind of statement we would like to have. And now the immediate problem which comes up is the following. Suppose we had a system of evolution equations which would allow us to prove something like that, then we wouldn't be done, because we'd also have to be able to show that the constraints were satisfied. And how are we going to get that? Normally, when you solve the initial value problem, you say the constraints should be satisfied on one initial hypersurface, and then you prove they propagate. But here, since we're starting on the singularity, we would need to somehow say the constraints are satisfied on the singularity and that those propagate. And we've tried that strategy for a while, but I mean, we got some equations which you might call constraints on the singularity, but we just couldn't recognize them as anything we could do anything with. So that requires a change of strategy then. And this change of strategy is what I'll call the velocity-dominated strategy. So the idea here is that instead of saying we have data at the singularity, we say the solution of the equations we're really interested in, namely the full Einstein equations, is approximated by a solution of a simpler system of equations, which will basically just be ordinary differential equations. And that simpler system is called the velocity-dominated system. This is terminology comes from the originally paper of Erdley and Smar on velocity-dominated singularities. So the idea is you try and approximate the solution of the full equations by solutions of a simplified system, and this simplified system is obtained, very roughly speaking, by throwing away the spatial derivatives, but I'll show you that in some more detail. So now it's a statement not about data directly, but a statement about having the right asymptotic behavior, and the right asymptotic behavior is defined by this velocity-dominated solution. So, what I want to do now is to just write out the 3 plus 1 form of the Einstein equations in Gauss coordinates, which you all know, and then I'll show you which terms to cross out to get the velocity-dominated system. So, I use the mixed components of the for good reasons, which will be mentioned later on. This SAB is just the space projection of the energy momentum tensor. So those are the evolution equations and then we also need the equation of motion for the matter field, which in this case is just the wave equation for the scalar field. So now, and of course, we have to substitute for the matter terms in terms of the energy momentum tensor of the scalar field. Now the simplifications will be that firstly you get rid of all curvature terms, so get rid of that. And the wave equation, what happens there is that the Laplacian, the three-dimensional Laplacian, which occurs in the wave equation, just drops out. And you get the following equation. And the other thing that happens is that this whole combination of matter terms here will actually vanish. So this is not something which is sort of essentially to do with velocity dominance alone, and so I'll cross this out in the other direction to show I'm crossing it out for another reason, the other ones. So it's just that if you look at the reduction of the energy momentum tensor that occurs because of velocity dominance, this whole expression just cancels out. So you get rid of all that. And that's very nice. That's incidentally special for a scalar field or a stiff fluid. So now if I do these things I just said with crossing out, see how simple the equations become. Oh, and I should also say that these quantities will also simplify. So this goes to 8 pi dt phi squared, and this goes to 8 pi dt phi radians phi. So now if I make those simplifications, then I'm left with this system, and this system is the velocity-dominated system.
So what was your we're keeping some special derivatives, obviously.
Yeah.
But not others. So what is it?
Trial and error. So I think there must be a more systematic way of doing it, but it was really just trial and error. And so, I mean, the reason you know you've done it right is that it works in the end. So that everything's consistent and you can actually construct solutions. I mean, a first point which shows you you're on the right track is that the velocity-dominated evolution equations propagate the velocity-dominated constraints, which is not at all obvious. I mean, the velocity-dominated evolution equations for the Einstein, for the geometry and for the scalar field are all ODEs. This constraint equation here is a PDE. So it's not at all clear that you can propagate solutions of a PDE by an ODE, but it's true. You can check that. Yes?
Can you do this at the level of the action and then do that that you do propagate the constraints consistently because the action still has some residual gauge effect?
Maybe I didn't try that. I just did it.
The action also has to get some specific variables, not other specific
variables. Right, but there may be in the action you can see why you could do certain things.
You can derive all these equations by throwing away the scalar curvature and the Hamiltonian constraint, and then just checking the Poisson algebra, the constraint still closes. It's not closing in the usual way, but it still closes, and that gives you all these equations and all the constraints.
Okay. Yeah, and these evolution equations, which are all ODEs, can be more or less solved explicitly. I'll say what I mean by more or less. If you look at this equation and take the trace and impose the condition that the trace of k is only allowed to blow up at t equals 0, then you find explicitly that trace k is just minus t to the minus 1. And you also find that the mixed components of k are all proportional to t to the minus 1. And that's the reason why here I'm using the mixed components of k, because if you imagine lowering an index with the metric will be terribly messy because you've mixed up all these powers being non-diagonal. So kb with lower indices would be horrible. But kb with mixed indices just goes like t to the minus 1. And then the last thing is, the scalar field. So this was what you asked Lee about, what does the scalar field do, so that looks like a of x log t plus b of x near the singularity. This is the solution of the velocity-dominated equations, and later on it will be, you know, the first term in the asymptotic expansion for the solution of the full equations.
Because your strategy is to solve these velocity-dominated equations and then show that the solution of the exact equation approach this.
Yes. So that the error is lower order than the explicit terms which occur here. In a sense.
So in particular, does this mean that once you've made the ansatz for the metric for velocity dominated, the ansatz that the gradient of the scalar field is always timelined is consistent?
Yeah, because essentially you find that it's only the time derivative of phi which plays a role and not the spatial derivative.
Right. And therefore, in this case, it would be, I don't know if you do it, but it would be consistent to reparameterize and choose phi as the time coordinate.
Presumably, I think Vince has looked at this kind of question of whether you can use, I mean, this phi satisfies the wave equation, so it's the question, can you use a harmonic time coordinate instead of a Gaussian one, and it appears that there are reasons to believe that you can do that.
So, but your control is really this is the behavior.
Yeah, this is the exact solution of the velocity-dominated system.
Yeah. The VFX is nothing arbitrary.
Yeah, it's arbitrary. These are arbitrary, sufficiently smooth functions of x.
So there could be a time where gradient of phi goes baseline. If d is strongly varying enough.
Well, yeah, there could be, but actually when we solve the constraints, we find that A must A can never vanish. A is not allowed to vanish within this velocity dominated ansatz. So A is going to sort of dominate eventually when you're close enough to the singularity.
Right.
Yeah, further away, we don't know, but we don't care. You know, what we're doing is trying to get information about what's happening close to the singularity. That's the whole aim of this procedure. And if Gauss coordinates do stupid things further away, which they no doubt do, then it's irrelevant for this question. Okay, so now the strategy, again, just to make it a bit more explicit, and this is in fact a strategy which owes a lot to discussions I had with Vince Moncrief last summer in Potsdam, when we were not being able to solve these constraints on the singularity. So the strategy is the following. Here's a picture. Take, let t equals 0 is supposed to be the singularity, and take some time t equals t naught greater than 0. So now what we do is we solve the velocity dominated constraints on t equals t naught. Then we evolve backwards using the velocity dominated system. We know that that preserves velocity dominated constraints, so we lose nothing. We also know, due to this semi-explicit form of the solution, that the solution actually exists all the way to t equals 0. There's no possibility for it to blow up. And once we've got this solution to t equals 0, we evolve forward again with the full equations and say that the solution of the full equations is asymptotic in a suitable sense to the solution of the velocity-dominated equations. So in that way, we parameterize the solutions of the full Einstein equations by solutions of the velocity-dominated constraints on this hypersurface, on this regular hypersurface. And to solve those equations, those velocity-dominated constraints, you can use a variant of the well-known conformal method. So that's not really anything that we don't know already. And moreover, you get the same number of free functions and so on as you would if you had the full Einstein equations. So this is a statement that you're really getting something of the full degree of generality.
When you say the full Einstein equation, does that include the Einstein
constraints? Yeah. Yeah, so I meant the velocity-dominated constraints have the same degree of generality of solutions as the full constraints. That's what I was wanting to say.
Coming back from t equal to 0, are you just solving the evolution equation, or the full evolution equation?
Yeah, when you solve backwards, mm-hmm. you're solving just the evolution equations, and then you have to show that the constraints are solved then. So that's an important step, to show that the constraints are actually solved.
So you use the usual conformal approach, but that works nicely on constant mean curvature. So now these are constant mean curvature, I guess.
Yeah, because we had trace k is t to the minus 1
that
somewhere.
That's an exact statement, not a symbolic statement.
That's an exact statement, yes.
So trace of k is a good time for that.
Yeah. Not for the exact equations, no, for the velocity-dominated solution. Okay, so now I've said something about how the problem is set up now, and the tool which we use, which I won't have much time to say much about, is we use theory of so-called Fuchsian equations, which are a certain class of singular partial differential equations. And a couple of years ago, Satya Kichanasamy and I proved a theorem on these equations, which was based on earlier work of Bawendi and Gulick. And this theorem, we proved this theorem to do something for Gaudi spacetimes, so for a very special class of spacetimes. But the same kind of theorem can also be applied in this much more general context. And we apply it to do several things. The one thing we apply it to do is that, as Dieter said, when we evolve forwards with full equations, we need an existence theorem for the evolution equations only, ignoring the constraints. So we need to show that we can write the evolution equations in Fuchsian form, so in the right form, in order that this theory can be applied. Another thing we need to do is we need to show that the constraint quantities satisfy a Fuchsian system which has a uniqueness statement, so that any solution which doesn't grow too fast at the singularity must be zero. So as a consequence of our ansatz, we know that the constraint quantities, after a lot of calculation, we know that the constraint quantities don't grow faster than that, therefore the uniqueness tells us they must be zero. Therefore we get that the constraints must be fulfilled.
So the constraints are satisfied if equal to zero is an appropriate sense for the proof theory?
No, so the point is the velocity-dominated constraints are satisfied by the velocity-dominated solution. And now this asymptotics we get say that the constraint quantities, the quantities that should be zero, in the full equations, are asymptotic to the quantities for the velocity-dominated equations, but the latter are zero. Therefore, this tells you that the constraint quantities in the full equations don't blow up too fast. The Hamiltonian constraint quantity doesn't blow up faster than, or it blows up slower than t to the minus 2, and the momentum constraint quantity blows up slower than t to the minus 1. And that's enough to use the uniqueness theorem for Fuchsian systems to say they must be zero.
Going back, I'm confused. So you want it to the singularity using the velocity-dominated equation?
Yes.
Then you got something at t equals zero. What do you get at t equals zero?
Nothing. We don't stop here before we go back again. We get a velocity-dominated solution which is defined on this interval. Yeah. And we now try to construct the solution of the full equations which on this interval agrees with this solution up to a certain order. I'll write down the explicit conditions in a minute. So it's really just a statement that we have two things, if you like, this one and this one running backwards in time, and those two agree sufficiently well in the limit as t goes to zero. But we never actually do anything on t equals zero. That's what we tried first and we didn't. It didn't work. Yeah. Okay.
It sort of seems like you're cheating. I know you're not, but what would have gone wrong to prevent you from getting an initial data set with the same number of free functions as generic data? I mean, you're basically doing the backwards evolution from something that has velocity dominated behavior. The solution will deviate from that at some rate, but in the sense of initial data, you can sort of force it to start out that way. So, I don't know how exactly to ask this, but how could it have happened that you would come to the opposite conclusion from the one that you did?
Well, let's maybe say what would have happened if we hadn't had the scalar field, because that must show what's going on, right? So if we hadn't had the scalar field, then we would have found that when we try and apply this Fuchsian theory, then basically what we need to know is that we need a uniqueness statement, and that comes down in the end to looking at the eigenvalues of a certain matrix. So you have to control the eigenvalues of this matrix, and the fact that those eigenvalues are the right sign, which is the important thing, is dependent on the fact that all the PIs are positive. So if I didn't have all the PIs positive, I couldn't do this. If I did, by some other method, manage to get the PIs being positive, I could essentially, I mean, in principle, probably do the same thing. However, BKL tell me if I really had vacuum, or if I had vacuum plus a fluid with a softer equation of state, then at least one of the PIs would be negative. Therefore, I couldn't do this. Is that?
In that case, what would happen when you tried to?
Well, you wouldn't be able. You wouldn't have an existence theorem to give you this step here. Moreover, you wouldn't have a uniqueness theorem which would tell you that the constraints were satisfied, even if you could satisfy the evolution equations.
Another point which is important is that the curvature, if you think about it, the potential in Hamiltonian, that would dominate over the velocity dominant system. So that means that as soon as you have a negative exponent, this separation into a dynamic system.
Yeah, that's a good point, in the sense that, you know, I stroked out all these terms, but if I hadn't had the PIs positive, the terms I stroked out would be bigger than the ones I kept. So you couldn't hope to get a self-consistent picture.
Presumably that's the signal that something like BKL oscillation is trying to happen, whereas this method is only good for velocity-dominated, truly velocity-dominated solutions. You just can't handle the BKL kind of solutions with this method yet.
Okay, so let me make one other statement, which is a sort of technical thing, but it's amusing maybe, namely that you find that the way you are forced to formulate the equations, you find that you don't know a priori that the metric is the metric. So in fact, what you have to do is you solve the equations without knowing that the metric is the metric, and then show that symmetry of the metric is automatic. So in other words, you derive a Fuchsian equation for the antisymmetric part of the metric, and knowing that the thing doesn't blow up too fast, you have uniqueness again, you know it must be zero. The reason why this non-symmetric metric comes up, we'll see in just 1 minute. So now, at last, I want to really write out this asymptotic form of the metric so that you can maybe leave that for comparison, so that you can see what it looks like. So here, my notation will be that everything which belongs to the velocity-dominated solution has a zero on it, and all objects which have a zero on them will have their indices raised and lowered with the metric with a zero on it, and all the ones that don't will have their indices raised and lowered with the true metric. So the one condition is that if I raise one index of the true metric with the velocity-dominated metric, then that should be equal to just Kronecker delta in leading order, and then after that there will be a t to the power alpha for some positive alpha, which I won't specify here precisely, and then there is a remainder term gamma AC, where gamma AC is O of 1, so gamma AC is bounded. Then for K, there's a similar thing, but KAB is K naught AB plus 4 of T to the minus 1 plus alpha. Well, I should say T to the minus 1 plus alpha times some kappa AB. And again, kappa AB is O of 1. So remember that K naught AB, which was the velocity dominated system, was such that all components went exactly like T to the minus 1. Therefore, this term with a t to the minus 1 plus alpha is a higher order term than from the t to the minus 1. And then for the scalar field, you also have similar things. So phi is phi naught plus some lower order term. And I remind you that phi was something times log t plus another function of x. Therefore, if this beta is positive, this is a lower order term again. And there's a similar equation for the time derivative. Fine. So this is the actual asymptotics which you get, and now the fact that you end up having to worry about non-symmetric metrics is because the fundamental the fundamental quantities which you work with are gamma and kappa, and they are mixed tensors, so they know nothing about symmetric or not symmetric, and that's why you have to do this sort of indirect argument.
So your statement is that I give you any solution with the G naught and K naught and phi naught of the velocity dominant, that there exists a solution G.
There exists a solution G with this asymptotic, subject to two conditions, which I still need to say. The one condition is that if lambda is an eigenvalue of this K naught AB, then that eigenvalue should be closer to 1/3 than 1/24. Lambda equals 1/3 is the Friedmann value. So this is saying you're not allowed to be too far away from the Friedmann data, whereby, of course, this is not an arbitrarily small epsilon. This is a definite number. Probably the right condition, so this in terms of the original BKL variables, this would just be not pi minus 1/3. It's less than 24th, and probably the correct condition is just that all pi are positive, which would be a much weaker condition, and we've been working on trying to show that, but we haven't yet succeeded. I'm still hoping it might work.
In fact, I'm still not clear about your two-sided evolution. There.
Yeah.
So I give you a G-naught, okay, with the solution to that. Now, what in practice your way of constructing G again? Where do you start and where does this arrow...
Yeah, so the point is, so you say, you give me a K-naught. Now, that must be a solution of the velocity-dominated system, okay? So the first step is, how do you produce solutions of the velocity-dominated system? And that was what this evolving backwards had to do with. But if you say, if you're happy to say, I give you a solution of the velocity-dominated system, then that's a suitable starting point for this. And then what I do is I plug this ansatz into the Einstein evolution equations and rewrite everything as an equation for gamma, kappa, and for a remainder term, psi, for the scalar field. And then that system of equations is now singular at t equals zero. So I now have to solve, and I have to show that system, singular system, has a unique solution. So, and that will then be a solution of the Einstein scalar field equation. That's the logic. And as I say, there is this assumption on the PIs, and there's also another assumption of a technical nature, namely that all the data you give should be analytic. Hopefully this can be removed in the future, but at the moment it's only for analytic data that we can do that.
Is this the same condition that you're working
together? Yeah, that's equivalent. I just wanted to make the connection between the BKL way of writing things and our way of writing things. Okay, so now I think I'm just at the point where I could come to my conclusion. So what is the conclusion? The conclusion is that by doing this, what we have been able to do is we've been able to construct a family of solutions of the Einstein scalar field, which functions as the general solution of the Einstein equation. So in the crude sense of function counting, general solutions. And moreover, for these solutions, we can describe rather precisely what the structure of the singularity is. And this description of the structure of the singularity is consistent with the old BKL picture in the sense that, on the one hand, a neighborhood of the initial singularity is covered by Gauss coordinates such that the singularity is just t equals zero, and also in the sense that the solutions of the full equations are approximated in a precise sense by solutions of ordinary differential equations, which are the velocity-dominated equations. And there's also here a connection to cosmic censorship, if you like. It's easy enough to show that all these solutions are such that the square of Ricci blows up uniformly as the singularity is approached. So there's no possibility of a violation of cosmic censorship within these solutions. Not exactly. I guess you can compute it, but it would depend on gamma naught. It would depend on the data for the metric. I mean, it's sort of the order of I mean, this thing here is the same as just no. In fact, I can say exactly what it does, because this is just the same as this. So it's the square. Square of the square. It's that, and that goes like t to the minus 4. So I do know how fast it goes. Yeah?
So your conditions are like a bound on the anisotropy at each point. You can't let these things start expanding too much faster in one direction than another.
Yeah.
But I don't see any bound on the inhomogeneity.
No, so the these functions of x which go into here, I mean, they can vary as much as they like, essentially.
So they could be very inhomogeneous.
Yes.
But
and you always can get this decoupling.
Yes.
Didn't you say before that you get some kind of relation between A of X and B of X?
No, there's no relation. These two belong to the data. So phi naught will be, so I should put a naught on this maybe, because this part of the data will just be something of that form where A and B can be, oh, I did say one thing, which was there will be an inequality on A, which comes from the Hamiltonian constraint. So, or I should say, if you want a solution of the Hamiltonian constraint such that all the PIs are positive, then A needs to be, it can't be too small, or it can't be zero in particular. So that's the only constraint on this. Otherwise, A can vary with X as much as it likes, and B also.
That must be connected to the interpretation that it's having a time migrating, therefore representing the fluid, but the singularity too, mustn't it?
Yeah. So this, I mean, when I write down this here, the point is that the time derivative is dominating the spatial derivatives, and I know what the time derivative is doing because of this formula. Okay, so just...
Yeah? There's a common thing that comes back about, for one product, to understand the velocity dominated equations, and the points of bracket, Hamiltonian constraint being invariant in the form that you chose out there. Now, could I just therefore, supposing one wrote it all in the Hamiltonian form, not in terms of K and G, but in terms of T, the momentum, which has a Newton's constant in it, explicitly. Are these equations precisely the equations I would get if I just put G to be in infinity or 1 upon G to be 0?
No, I'm just stated slightly. What I was thinking is, I certainly believe I can show, is that you get this if you drop all the terms in the Hamiltonian constraint that involve spatial derivatives. So that's both the scalar curvature and the gradient of phi, which I forgot to say earlier. And that leaves nothing but squares of momenta, so to speak. That's the momentum constraint stays the same, including the scalar field and so forth. And the claim is the Poisson bracket algebra, that closes, and that the Hamilton's equations and the constraints are these velocity dominated.
Right. So I'm just trying to understand. So remove the threshold from this factor, provided this happens. My obvious guess would be that when you write down these equations using, you know, the moment and Hamiltonian form, there is actually a Newton's constant putting over all the players.
Yeah.
And therefore, in some sense, we have one parameter Fourier equation. And therefore, if I just took the limit in which 1 upon G goes to 0, and I got the points of bracket relations, and they're all closed.
Does that multiply the right terms? I mean, I don't usually put the G where you may put it, but I mean, put it equal to 1.
No. G comes all over the place in the vacuum equations, and I'm going to probably G everywhere.
Well, where does it just multiply the
So it will multiply the scalar curvature term, for example. And not the TT term.
But what about the gradient product?
And this is potentially intensive. Well, that was really my question about whether it works off on the right hand side. That was really the vacuum case, I know, this all works.
But it sounds like it wouldn't, right? Because the G would not differentiate between the grad dots, I mean, the phi dot term and the grad phi.
No, it does. Yes. Maybe
it differentiates between momentum.
So maybe just let me say my closing words, and then you can continue to discuss as long as you like. So the closing words is simply what we can't yet do and what we would like to do and what we hope we will soon be able to do. The one thing is, I mentioned this analyticity thing, which maybe to many of you, doesn't bother many of you maybe, but it bothers me. And so I would like to replace this by smooth, because there's no reason why analyticity should play a role here. It's just, I think, a technical thing. But what's more important about that is if you could go from analytic to smooth, you'd have the possibility of trying to really prove that you get a whole non-empty open set of initial data on a regular Cauchy surface by this construction, therefore you would know that the thing was stable not just in the vague sense of function counting, but really in the sense you'd know that for an open set of initial data close to the Friedmann data, all the solutions have the same type of singularity. And that's a feasible thing to do, I think. Similar things have been done for simplified problems by Kichin-Asami, so I hope that that can be done in the not too distant future. The second thing, which I've already mentioned, is the restriction on P. We would like to just have PI greater than 0 rather than the sting with 1/24th. And the third thing is the stiff fluid should work like the scalar field, but I haven't done it yet. We've just done some calculations on that, but it isn't complete yet. So now the discussion can begin.